So part two of the lecture. Renormalization and QED, but just to pick up where we left off. So what did we just find? So in free theory, for phi, so this is to remind us that it's bare field in Lagrangian. So there's a bare field that lives in Lagrangian. This is the field that is part of the Lagrangian as we would normally write it down. This is the same phi that we've always seen. The free theory has a propagator, d4x e to the ipx, some time-ordered product of phi x, phi 0, and we can find, just by using commutation relations and evaluating this thing explicitly and taking its Fourier transform, that the pole has residue, residue I. So technically it would have residue of 1 because this is something that when we take it to 0, there would be a minus I downstairs. But it doesn't matter. The point is that the propagator has this form. And you can check me on factors of I. And the problem is, with interactions, the vacuum is different. That's 0. So we're going to define a thing that I'll call Z phi. Okay. So Z phi is called the called the wave function renormalization constant, which is kind of a bad name for it because wave function makes you think non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It's also called the field strength renormalization, which is more intuitive, I think, in context. This is the field strength for normalization. And what we do is now by hand, what we're going to do is define a renormalized field phi of x as 1 over z phi times the bare field of x, so that this object now looks in the form that looks like it has the form that we'd want it to have. And I'm going to write it suggestively. Times omega. And now this has the right pole structure, has the right residue. Okay. And there might be other terms, but these terms don't mess up the pole. So we don't care about them. And that's it. So we can we have a field phi r. So what happens to the Lagrangian? So in the Lagrangian, now we want to write everything in terms of what we've defined phi 0. Our Lagrangian was written in terms of phi 0. So let me just write down the Lagrangian, and then we'll talk about it. So 1 half del mu phi 0 del mu phi 0 plus other stuff. I'm not going to care about what that other stuff is, but you do the same sort of thing for every other interaction. And I want to just write this using this definition. So now write it in terms of, write in renormalized, oh man, I can't keep a piece of chalk together. So we're just doing a rescaling of the fields. So now phi zero is root z times phi renormalized. So that's going to give us z phi over 2. Del mu phi renormalized, del mu phi renormalized plus dot dot dot. But that's still not the end of the story, because now the kinetic term has the wrong normalization, or kinetic term is non-canonical. And we'd like to be able to use all the machinery from the free field theory that allows us to write down propagators and so on. The only definition of a propagator in terms of a Feynman diagram, or any Feynman diagram in terms of anything for that matter, came from the free theory. And that's a free theory that didn't have any of these z's. The free theory had a kinetic term that looked just like this. But now we've added some more interactions to it, which means that the vacuum was different, which means that we introduced a field strength renormalization constant, which we had to scale away in order to make the propagator look proper again. But that z showed up in the kinetic term when we rewrote the fields in terms of the renormalized objects. Now, the renormalized objects obey usual Feynman rules. Because now this expression now looks the way that it does in free field theory. Terms that don't screw up the propagator. So now we wanted, so these are the fields that live in the, So these are the fields that live in the Feynman diagrams. And that's only consistent if we write the Lagrangian in a way that has the right coefficient out front. So L becomes I can write this as del mu phi renormalized, del mu phi renormalized, plus, and this is the slippery part, z phi minus 1, del mu phi renormalized, del mu phi renormalized. Okay, so this is the proper kinetic term. This is a new interaction. The price we pay for rescaling the fields to make the propagators look the way that they should look is that the constant that we had to divide by in order to achieve this form showed up in our Lagrangian. But our Lagrangian only makes sense if the kinetic term has a factor of 1 or 1/2, depending on how many identical fields there are. If it has that kind of normalization out front, and we can restore that renormalization just by separate, or restore that normalization by separating out the part that looks like the usual part and whatever's left over. And so we're going to define new interaction as delta phi times del mu phi, del mu phi. This is not a kinetic term. This is just some term in the potential. This is some term in the potential. And there's a new Feynman rule. Where I'm going to insert a little block. This is to tell us that it came from this operator. So this is this block here. And it's going to have the value I delta 3 times p squared. OK? So everything else about the theory is what we normally have. And it's a bad day for chalk. But we've added a new interaction to the Feynman rules, and we define delta 3 inside the theory to be consistent with our desired pole in the propagator at p squared equals m squared, as it should have, okay? So, this is delta phi. Oh, yeah, thanks. Sorry, I'm getting a little ahead of everything. Okay, so that's just delta phi, all right? And that's it. So what we would normally do, we now just do with an extra interaction that has to be included consistently. Must be included wherever there is possibility of pole being shifted. So this is why we don't have to worry about this at tree level. At tree level, there's nothing. There's no interaction that we can write down that'll shift the position of that pole in say a phi 4 theory. Now, there's nothing special about scalar phi. This is true for any field. Any field in any QFD interacting And so we're going to consider a special case. We're going to consider QED. Quantum electrodynamics with fermion, Dirac fermion, psi. Okay. So how does this kind of argument work in QED? So now each field has its own z. Okay? So we have LQED, which first I'll write in terms of the bare fields. The bare fields are the ones that we've always ever seen. But I'll write it suggestively. So this is to remind us that the photon field now is bare. So this is the usual kinetic term, I psi bar 0, del mu psi bar 0. And this is the free field part. If this were the whole story, if this were it, so if this were the whole story, there are no psi A interactions. Then all Z's are 1. But it's not the whole story, because we're also adding E0. This is the usual coupling for QED. And then psi 0 A mu 0, gamma mu 0, Dirac matrix gamma, and psi 0. Questions? No? All right, so QED coupling. And we're turning on this interaction. So now we have to define Zs. Z's for, man, for psi and A. And it's just convention, and it's sort of a strange convention, but we're gonna do it anyway. So we're gonna say that A0 is defined to be A renormalized times Z3 to the 1/2. This is the photon field strength renormalization. Constant, so that's just the definition of Z3. And we're going to define the fermion field strength renormalization constant as, I should make that clearly a zero, times Z2 times 1/2. Okay. So now let's just write down the Lagrangian of QED in the same sort of way that we did for the scalar, where we inserted everything, where we defined the bare fields in terms of the renormalized fields. So there's going to be a minus 1/4 Z3 F mu nu renormalized squared. So that's just the usual field strength tensor written in terms of renormalized fields. I've just rewritten the A0 to be rescaled by Z3 to the 1/2. There's going to be Z2 times I psi renormalized bar, del slash psi renormalized, where the slash just tells us this is picking out gamma mu del mu. It's the Feynman slash notation. And we're going to have E0 times Z2 Z3 to the 1/2 times A mu renormalized, psi renormalized, gamma mu, psi renormalized. Okay? Now, by convention, E0 can be defined. This will just be our definition of a physical charge. So the convention is E0 times Z2 times Z3 to the 1/2 is defined to be Z1 times E physical. Okay, so this we'll think of as the renormalized electric charge. Okay. And it seems like a stupid definition. I haven't told you what Z1 is. We can take this to just be a definition of Z1 because everything else here already shows up in this step. It's a definition of the combination Z1 times the physical charge. And the rationale is gauge invariance. Because this term and this term combine to give you a covariant derivative. And if gauge symmetry is something that's preserved in the program of renormalization, then these two terms have to renormalize in the same way. So gauge invariance requires, so now I'm just stating that this actually happens. There's a proof to all orders that this actually does happen. But gauge invariance requires that we write down Z2 psi bar renormalized. I'm going to put the I inside. Del psi plus E physical times A slash renormalized. This is just A mu renormalized gamma mu. and cyber normalized, where this is just the definition of gamma mu times d mu with a physical charge. And this is only possible if Z1 equals Z2 in QED, which it does. Does C QFT Matthew Schwartz? Textbook, which is a very fine new textbook. And so there's a proof to all orders in perturbation theory that that actually happens. And so now we note that if Z1 equals Z2, then there's a special relationship between the electric charge, the bare value of the electric charge and the physical value, because then the Z1 will just cancel the Z2. So this will be what we use later on to determine Z3 to the minus 1/2. I've just put the Z3 on the other side. Okay. So the physical value of the coupling is set by Z3 coupling determined only by Z3, the photon field strength renormalization constant. So if we know how the photon's field strength renormalizes, we'll also know how the charge renormalizes. Ah, crap. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so in what sense do you think about that term as an attraction?
Which term?
The is with the delta phi.
Oh, in the scalar case?
Yeah.
We'll make that clear in the case of the photon. I didn't want to spend too much time on scalar field theory since we're not going to be considering it anymore. But let's do the case of QED. It's exactly the same idea. So that's where we're headed right now. So the goal is find Z3. So what is it? Z3 has to be chosen in order to ensure that the propagator to make a mu propagator okay. Pole in right place. And adding interactions with the fermion field psi might jeopardize that, because we're going to now have other diagrams that correct this at loop level, because everything not forbidden is compulsory, and so every kind of diagram that you can write down is going to contribute to everything that you want to consider. So what's the photon propagator? In the free theory, I'm going to define a g mu nu of p squared to be the photon propagator. And it's going to have the usual structure. So just IG mu nu. I want to be more general than this. So that's the usual form that it'll have. I want to consider the possibility that it might have a slightly different form. So we can write down G mu nu minus 1 minus C P mu P nu over P squared. So this is in an arbitrary gauge. So in an arbitrary gauge defined by some parameter C. You freely pick C depending on your needs at the moment. So if you want to make a calculation simpler, you might choose C to be 1 so that this term disappears. That's what we're going to do, but that's not always the most convenient choice, because this thing, it has a very nice structure when c is set to 0, because then this is something that just projects. It annihilates the 4-vector p mu, because then this part contracted into p mu will cancel that part. So this has some nice properties. This is an arbitrary gauge. Now, without loss of generality, I'm going to pick Feynman gauge, where c is 1. So the photon propagator is going to become I over p squared. And I'm going to assume gauge invariance throughout. So the standard treatment of this kind of calculation is going to assume the general case. And in the general case, you have to argue that gauge invariance is restored regardless of what parameter you choose. We know it's going to happen. You can consult the literature on this. For simplicity, I'm just going to say that it's totally fine to choose this gauge, which means that we're going to have just the g mu nu term. And all corrections will have this form. If gauge invariance holds. If gauge invariance holds. Okay. So what kinds of things could potentially give us corrections to the photon propagator? That's the free case. In the free case, there are no corrections. But what happens in the interacting case? With interactions, we have to adjust kinetic term. So we've written out the Lagrangian with the factors of z just in terms of in front of the usual operators. But what we can do in order to legitimately use Feynman diagrams and propagators and so on, I'm going to write this as the renormalized field squared plus I psi bar gamma mu psi, this is the renormalized version, plus there are more terms, but I'm only going to be interested in one of them, and you can work out for yourselves what the rest of them are, but there's one term that looks like z3 minus. Okay. So one term that looks like z3 minus 1 times f mu nu renormalized squared, and then there are other things. All the other terms that look like kinetic terms, we're going to call these things counter terms. Well, I'm going to define this thing to be delta 3, which is why I originally called that thing delta 3 mistakenly. And so all operators that arise shifting or rescaling fields are counter terms, just by definition. And you have to include them if you do calculations at higher loop order. They have to be included consistently. So now, what are the Feynman rules? For A mu renormalized. So there's the usual Feynman rule. Now that we've written it in this language, this is now just treated as an interaction. And these are always interactions. So we include them in diagrams. So the usual Feynman rules now for the free for the propagator with nothing else in it, the usual one that we know and love is just g mu nu over p squared. Okay. So now there's also a counter term that looks like I delta 3 p squared g mu nu. If we had chosen a slightly different gauge, or if we'd been more generic about this, there would have been terms that are proportional to p mu p nu, and those terms would vanish with the appropriate choice of gauge. So just note these can shift in other gauges. This is the only set of the rules that are going to be relevant for us. So I'm going to put a box around them. Okay. All right, so now let's consider the general form of interacting propagator for A mu, for the renormalized field. So I G mu nu of P squared is going to include terms that look like this. So these are just the Feynman diagrams. General form, i.e. in diagrams. So there's the usual propagator-like, the usual thing that looks like a free propagator. So I'm just going to put quotation marks around that. But now we're including things at the one loop level. So this will be our first encounter with a loop diagram, where this is A, this is psi, and this is A. And so this is a tensor of mu nu. So there's an incoming photon line with index mu and an outgoing one of index nu. And the same is true here, mu nu. And this will be some sort of tensor that contracts into these. And so the value of this loop diagram is going to be set by whatever the computation of this tensor is. And we also have to include the counter term. And the counter term arises at the same loop order as the same order as the loop. Okay. And then this is also going to have the structure mu and nu, and of course it already does, because that's the definition that we gave it right here. Okay. So the generic structure of this thing we can think of in the following way. So here, minus I g mu nu over p squared. So that's just the usual propagator piece, right? This is not a scattering amplitude, so I don't amputate any external legs. There's just one leg, and that's a propagator. Here, there is, let me just write this in a sort of suggestive way, g mu alpha over p squared. So that tells me that there's this line, which has the same kind of structure as this. But then there's going to be something that I'm going to call pi alpha beta, and it depends on p squared. This will be the value of the loop diagram. The loop diagram, and it's contracted into another propagator. So there's g beta nu over p squared. So now I've contracted alphas and betas. So this whole thing still has the structure of g mu nu. And then we do the same thing for mu alpha for the counter term. So there's a photon line, counter term, photon line. And that's going to have the value I delta 3 p squared g alpha beta minus I g beta nu over p squared. And now we can group this term and this term. Group loop and counter term. So we should talk a little bit about what the structure of pi is. So before we get there, so just note pi alpha beta of p squared has to preserve gauge invariance. Okay. And that means it has to have a very specific form. We could say generically that pi alpha beta can be something that goes like p squared times g mu nu times something that I'll call pi of p with no tensor indices. And generically, it could also have something that I'll call delta, which could also have maybe the structure p mu and p nu. But this is gauge dependent. That's gauge dependent. And so we can ignore it because we've chosen a gauge where all the stuff that could have been written in the propagator as it's written in its most generic form, where all this stuff is just set to zero by our choice of xi, which tells us that anything else that can arise, if it's gauge invariant, if the theory remains gauge invariant after we've added these other terms, everything else that arises has to preserve that Lorentz structure. Because the choice of gauge will hold throughout the calculation. And so really we can just replace this with p squared g mu nu pi of p. Okay? And so the goal is going to be to calculate this. Okay? Where should I continue? Let's go to the other board. All right. My other goal is to break every piece of chalk. Okay, so we're going to group loop and counter term. So we've given it that structure. Note that the counter term already has that structure. So there's a delta 3 times p squared times g alpha beta. It's already got the structure that we're dictating. So really, the full form of the propagator full propagator has the form minus I g mu nu over p squared plus minus I g mu alpha over p squared. Something wrong? No? Okay. So I can cancel one of the p squareds because I had to write it as p squared times the g mu nu. So I'm going to cancel one of the p squareds that came out of that. So now I can write this as pi of p squared plus delta of 3. So after this is all expanded out, it'll have this structure after you contract all the Lorentz indices. And then there are going to be higher order things. So these are going to be more complicated loops. So loops of order e to the fourth. So here we're considering only the corrections of order e squared. And e is going to be the physical value of the charge. All right. And now this is where the by hand part comes in. So now the strategy is going to be as follows. So one, we're going to calculate pi of p squared, and it will be divergent. We're going to regularize that divergence, i.e. we're going to isolate its poles. Or its infinities, but the way we'll do it is going to involve poles in dimensional regularization. And then we're going to choose delta 3 to fix the propagator. So just like in the case of the simple scalar, we want the propagator to look like I g mu nu over p squared at values of, as p squared goes to zero, because that's where the pole is going to be. So we want the residue of this thing to look like I. And if that's true, then it has to be the case that delta 3 takes on a value that cancels this object when p is 0. This is the analog of rescaling our usual quantum mechanical wave functions after we do perturbation theory to ensure that our normalization is what it needs to be for the theory to make sense. So we're going to need delta 3 to equal minus pi of 0. This will be our renormalization condition, one of several, but this is for our purposes, this is going to be our condition. Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So the only thing left to do is calculate that loop diagram. So I'm only going to be able to sketch it out because it's kind of an involved calculation, but it is straightforward. And there's a sort of recipe for doing all calculations of this sort. They're always annoying, and they always take a fair bit of time. But once you've done one and you've convinced yourself that you know how to do it, then all the other ones are just tedious exercises that follow the same pattern. Okay, so what's the diagram look like? So, oh, this is not erasing very well. So pi mu nu, the value of the diagram is tensorial because it contracts into photon propagators. And so I apologize about the not erased parts. So I pi mu nu, I wrote on a wet board. So okay, I pi mu nu is going to be defined to be this diagram. And so in the usual Dirac language, so this is a psi. This is mu. These are the indices of the external legs. That means this thing is going to have to contract into a mu, and this vertex is going to have to contract into a nu. And there's some momentum flowing through this diagram. That's the momentum of the incoming photon line. That's the same momentum going out of it. So there's a momentum that's inside the loop that we have to integrate over. And so I can call this line k, which is the momentum of this fermion propagator. And I can call this momentum k minus p, where k is just a loop momentum. Pardon? P minus k, yeah. OK. Let me just double check something. Okay. All right. Okay, so this is going to have the numerical form, and I don't have time to work it out in detail. But it's going to look like d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. This is the issue. It is p minus k, but this momentum is flowing in this direction. So I do want to keep it as k minus p. I just have to be clear about which way it's flowing. Okay. So d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. There's going to be some function in the numerator which has tensor structure. It's going to depend on p and k. And they're going to be fermion propagators that look like p minus k squared. I'm squaring it, so I don't care about the order. Minus m squared and k squared minus m squared. Okay? The numerator, so first of all, this is because there's a fermion loop. So every time there's a fermion loop in a diagram, it costs you a sign penalty. This is the Feynman rule for the two vertices. This momentum, I'm sometimes just going to say that this is d slash 4k, so I don't have to write out the pi's, just like h bar defines something over 2 pi. And n mu nu is going to be the trace of the fermionic propagators in the numerator with the right gamma matrices inserted. So this is going to be gamma mu k slash minus p slash plus m times gamma nu k slash minus m. This is just some numerator function. And I'm told that I can do this till 11:15. Was that right? Okay, well, you could blame Gong. sorry. I'm sure there's going to be a pun that'll that'll make it all better. Okay. Okay, I look forward to the gong. That way I don't have to worry about time. So the numerator function has that form. I should have also put in an I squared because each fermion propagator looks like I times, say, k slash minus m plus m over k squared minus m squared. So these are the I's that came from the two propagators. This is the structure of the trace. Okay. So now, step one. Okay. I'm renormalizing all the chalk. Yeah, we're about to hit the lattice spacing on this one. Okay, so step one is going to be to simplify fermion trace. All right, so the trace came about because this has no spinner index, this has no spinner index. So if there's a loop of spinners, you can find that it'll amount to a trace over all the spinner indices. So we're going to simplify it, so we need to use the identities. And I won't actually simplify it for you, but we need to use the identities. A trace of a bilinear of gamma matrices is just g mu nu, 4g mu nu. Okay, that's a useful one to know. You should just memorize it. Trace gamma mu, gamma nu, gamma rho, gamma sigma. There's a simple way to memorize this one. So there's four. So the first term is just a product of g mu nu's, but it has the same structure. So now I just do mu nu rho sigma. First one's the same. Second one is first and last, and then the middle two. So that's going to be g mu sigma g nu rho. And then the last one is the odd combination. So that's going to be this and this, and this and this. So that's going to be g mu rho g nu sigma. Okay, so these come up all the time, and it helps not to have to look them up. Note also that the trace of an odd number of gamma matrices is zero. Okay, so those are all the tools we're going to need. So now I'm just going to erase this stuff. Okay, so step two. Well, before I get to step two, I should just write out what n mu nu is. So it's going to be 4 times k mu p nu minus k mu p nu plus 2 k mu k nu plus g mu nu minus k squared plus p dot k plus m squared. Okay, and we can ignore these terms because they'll contribute to the thing that we've set to zero by our gauge choice. So these are actually going to be gauge dependent. So we can ignore them. So the numerator is going to become 4 times, well, so the whole thing, actually, why don't I just write that out? So I times pi mu nu is going to become minus 4 e squared d slash 4k. And in the numerator, there's going to be 2 k mu k nu. So we're integrating over all the k's. So when it's all said and done, this might end up looking like g mu nu. So we got to keep it. But we only want the part that's going to be proportional to g mu nu. So g mu nu minus k squared plus p dot k plus m squared. And it's going to be divided by things that I'll suggestively call a times b, which takes us to step two. Use the Feynman parameters. Everything's Feynman in this business. Use the Feynman parameters where the identity is 1 over AB is dx 0 to 1, 1 over x times A plus 1 minus x times B squared. And A is going to be k squared minus m squared, and B is k minus p squared minus m squared. So the virtue of doing it this way is that now we take a multiplicative denominator, and the denominator is now additive. If the denominator is additive, we can just do a linear shift on the fields. So then we can redefine. We can define L mu to be our loop momentum. So we're going to say that this is K mu plus 1 minus x p mu, and then complete square. So we complete the square in the denominator. And then we change variables. But changing the variables from k to l doesn't introduce anything in the Jacobian. It's just a linear shift. So now I pi mu nu is going to be minus 4 e squared d4l, this is the loop momentum, dx 0, 1, 2 l mu l nu minus g mu nu times l squared minus x times 1 minus x times p squared minus m squared. Let me make it clear that that's a square bracket. And in the denominator, we've traded a multiplicative thing of a times b for something that now just looks like l squared plus p squared x times 1 minus x minus m squared squared. Okay? I'm going to define this quantity here to be delta. It's going to be some function delta of p. And I can erase on this side. Yes, sorry. Okay, I mean, it doesn't matter. We can keep it in the, pardon? I have a fix, one that I haven't written on yet? Oh, good. Ah, so I do. All right, thanks. Okay. So now the integral is in the form. So now it's in that form. We want to evaluate integrals of the form d4l, things that could either look like l mu l, I want to put it upstairs, l mu l nu over l squared minus delta squared, and d4l times 1 over l squared minus delta squared. Okay. These integrals are divergent. So we don't care. This might be divergent, but the divergence isn't physical because ultimately we're only calculating this thing here. And we still need to define a delta 3 in order for our theory to make sense. Nothing that we do without this combination is ever physical, because this is the thing that tells us what our propagator looks like. Only that difference is physical. And so we can work in d dimensions. D dimensions, and Wick rotate. So in Wick rotation, if you evaluate these integrals as contours, and I'm only going to breeze through this, but if you evaluate them as contours, the propagators secretly have the I epsilons downstairs. And so if I just consider integration over the real part of L0 and the imaginary part of L0, and I'm integrating along the real axis, because these are momenta, the poles in the propagator from the I epsilon, so this is going to be like L0 is the square root of L squared plus M squared, or plus delta squared, minus I epsilon. As long as I choose an integration contour that doesn't encircle any poles, then I can do this integral by the method of contours. And so the real integration is going to be equal to the integration along the imaginary axis. And in that case, we can do a Euclidean shift, or work in Euclidean space with a Euclidean vector where the zeroth component is just taken to be I times L0. And that means that all of our L squareds, which are L0 squareds minus L squareds, are going to be shifted into just the usual dot products plus L vector squared. And now we can do this in spherical coordinates in D dimensions. Okay? Sorry, where in the diagram? Here? Here? Oh, sorry. So this is just from the definition of the propagator. So it's like p squared minus, we've grouped everything into some delta, but there's always an I epsilon for causality, right? So it's p squared minus the square root of, well, it's L squared minus the square root of, what I actually have is L0 is, the position of this pole is going to be L squared plus delta. So this is like a fictitious mass. And for this one, it's minus I epsilon. And there's going to be another one here that's similar, but with signs reversed. And so if you choose this contour, then it's clear that doing the integration on the imaginary line is equivalent to doing it on the real line, provided that you do this rescaling. And I am just going to say that their identities say, the appendix of just about any quantum field theory book, say Peskin, Schwartz will have it, Ms. Rednicki will have it. So there are identities for how to do these things in D dimensions, because now once you shift to Euclidean space, where it's say DD L Euclidean, which is now related to, this is now, the identity is actually this, because I'm only taking one of these components and I'm making it imaginary to put my contour on the imaginary axis. So this is the DL to the D in Minkowski space. So this is and this is now just some, I want to just remind us that we've rewritten everything in L to be a function of either, well, everything in the denominator is going to be a function of L squared. And we can also use L mu, L nu to be equal to 1 over D times G mu nu L squared in D dimensions. And I should probably stop here. So we'll pick this up again on Monday. But just to suggest where this is all headed. So the idea is we're going to do these integrals. We want to use them. We want to use Wick rotation to work in Euclidean space, because this thing can then just be written as an angular integral in D minus one dimensions times an integral of L Euclidean in D minus one times L Euclidean. And now this is just some nice times f of L Euclidean squared. So now this is just some nice spherically symmetric integral, and we know how to do these. There are just some identities for how to do these kinds of integrals in arbitrary numbers of dimensions. This one will have the rotationally symmetric form because we can use this identity, and those are the only two that we actually encounter in this calculation. And so once we get the specific form that'll depend on p and on x, because we're not doing anything about the x integration, then that's sufficient to figure out what this delta 3 needs to be. We just define it to have the structure of whatever expression these identities pop out, and then these will generically be expanded, expand in a parameter that I'll call epsilon, not to be confused with the I epsilon prescription. That's the curly epsilon. So expand an epsilon where we define 4 minus epsilon to be D. So we're actually doing the integral in a slightly lower number of dimensions. And we're going to take the limit where epsilon goes to 0. Epsilon goes to 0, and all of our divergences are poles. Are poles of epsilon. So all of our divergences are going to look like C sub n, epsilon n. And our goal is to isolate the coefficients of these things. Those are going to define what delta 3 needs to be in order for a propagator to have the right form. So I guess that's where I absolutely have to stop. Okay.